This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. For information, 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. Good morning. Welcome to the Thursday Radio Zine. Coming up on the program today, first I'll have an interview with Heather Rogers, author of Gone Tomorrow, a look at the history of garbage in our culture. At 9:30, it's Teresa Mitchell with Press Watch. At 10 o'clock, an interview with Maestro Stefan Minda of the Portland Opera. And at 10:30 on Art Focus, it's a look at the 3D Center of Art and Photography. This is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine. I'm speaking with Heather Rogers. She is a writer, journalist, and filmmaker. Her new book is Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. That's also the title of a documentary film she made in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, she looks at garbage as a global problem, an American problem, and asks how we got so much trash and why we handle it the way we do. Heather Rogers, welcome to KABU.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. Talk a little bit, if you would, about how you got interested in this particular topic.
I got interested in finding out where my garbage went. It was something that, it's a substance that I make every day, and it's something that everyone else makes every day, and yet we don't see it. It seems like it disappears, but I knew that it didn't, and I wanted to know where it went. And once I started researching it, and this was for the film, once I started researching it, I realized that it was this substance that, you know, I expected to find out about the environmental effects of garbage. But what I kept coming across was the role of the market in the creation of waste and how central that was. And I realized that garbage is a substance through which I could talk about the market's relationship to nature in a way that it's harder to do with other things. And it's also a substance through which you can see the connection between daily life and larger environmental crises that normally are very abstract and, you know, somewhere it happens somewhere else beyond what we can see, but garbage is something that we see every day, and it's this unique substance in the way that it can help us make that those connections.
You talk a lot about the history of the garbage problem in your book, and I wanted to ask you to kind of get into that area. Whether we've always had such an intense garbage problem, is that a modern phenomenon, or has that always been with us?
Modern garbage as we know it is something new. The substance of garbage has changed dramatically over the last 100-150 years. And there are a couple key points in its development, which begin with the Industrial Revolution. And that's when you have commodities becoming cheap enough for people to start throwing things away. It's also when you have concentrated populations coming into urban centers for work and no longer having the space to store goods to repair them and reuse them. And so then there's a greater kind of logistical reason to buy new things and throw them away when they don't work anymore. And the next point of development on what I keep referring to now as the garbage timeline is the creation of sanitation engineering, which happened initially in right around the turn of the century, but then really comes into its own in the 1930s in its relation to garbage production. That's when you have the creation of the first sanitary landfill, which was built in 1934 in Fresno, California. And the sanitation engineer, the role that they play is really crucial because they help construct garbage as this other kind of substance. It's a technical problem. It's a substance that needs to just be put in its proper place. It's no longer something that has value that can be reused and recycled and remade.
So with the the development of the sanitary landfill. Can you talk a little bit more about what that actually meant? I mean, just even using the term sanitary and landfill, were there landfills before that were deemed unsanitary, or how did that all develop?
There were landfills before that were deemed unsanitary. There's some really gruesome descriptions in the book that people might enjoy reading that are pretty shocking. But there were a lot of attempts at finding out, trying to figure out ways to bury garbage. You know, they would call it improved burial. There were all these different names for it. And the idea was basically, you know, to somehow control, you know, there would be explosions from the methane gas that would build up underground from the rotting organic waste. There would be, you know, just massive infestations of rats and insects and roaches and maggots, and it was really terrible, and the smells were terrible. So they were constantly trying to improve and you know, deal with these problems. And the reason that they kept working on the landfill was that landfills are the cheapest disposal method. Before that, there was, you know, they would dump at sea. There was also, you know, incineration's been around since the 19th century, but it was always too expensive, as it is today. It's more expensive than any other disposal, widely used disposal method. So they kept focusing on the landfill. How do we put garbage into the land in a way that's, you know, that's acceptable and that makes sense logistically, because it's the cheapest method, and it continues to be the cheapest method. Today, landfilling is more profitable than all other waste industry operations combined. And so there's an incentive for, you know, now we have the corporatization of garbage, which is something that really happened in the 1980s and 1990s. And these corporations like Waste Management Incorporated, Allied, USA Waste, these are some of the top garbage corporations. Their, you know, motivating force is to get as many wastes into the ground as possible, because the more trash, the more cash. And that means that they're not going to promote in any meaningful way composting programs or recycling programs or waste diversion programs of any kind, because it doesn't serve the bottom line.
So just getting people to throw away more things helps them.
It boosts profits.
That is part of the explanation as to why the attempts to deal with garbage have led to greater amounts of garbage, which is a basic point that you make in the book. Is there anything else that you want to say about that particular phenomenon?
There's this story that our culture tells itself about why we have so much, say, packaging waste. And it's that producers, you know, especially after World War II, producers were just changing the way that they delivered products to people so that they could make them more convenient, because that's what consumers demanded. They wanted their lives to be easier, and part of that greater ease was more disposability. But when I went in and did this research, I found out a very different story. And what that story was that by the end of the 1950s...
Locations of that time.
That time was really significant. It was the first time since this shift to mixing everything together and throwing it all away. It was the first time that people started saying, wait a minute, this isn't right, this doesn't make sense. And that's a really significant moment. And people had said that before, but they didn't have enough political power to make an impact. And in the 70s they did. And what that meant was you had some pretty great developments happening in the 70s, which are worth just touching on really briefly, because there were some people calling for things which today sound quite radical. So people were asking for things like, you know, we have this slogan now, reduce, reuse, recycle, which was first used in the 70s. And when you hear that, you think like, oh, right, that's the recycling slogan. But actually, it's not. It's, you know, there is a sort of hierarchical orientation to it. First, you reduce consumption. So that means that you don't buy as much, and then you reuse as much as you can. And then as a last resort, you recycle. And now the way that the system works is the first thing we do is waste. The second thing we do is recycle, or try to recycle. And the third thing, you know, there is no third thing. There is no reducing, and there is hardly any reusing. And so there were a lot of activists in the 70s that were calling for product stewardship. They were calling for increased product durability and serviceability. There were laws passed. There was a law passed in Minnesota that said that the public had a say in what kind of packaging manufacturers used, and it was challenged by members of groups like the National Association of Manufacturers and also a group called Keep America Beautiful, which we can talk about more if you want, because they've played a very key role in helping construct the culture of waste that we live in today. And these members of these groups sued against this law, and it went to the state Supreme Court, and they ruled in favor of the law, but then the judge gutted any means of implementing the law, so it foundered. It's still important to point out that, you know, there were actions like this being taken, and it's also important to look at their backlash to these, and in groups like Keep America Beautiful, which was started in the 1950s by packaging and beverage makers who saw the potential for regulation of, you know, the materials that they made to be disposable. And what they set out to do was to create this beautification group that would teach people how to not, they, you know, it created this category called litter, and it created this person called the litter bug. And the idea was to, you know, shift the responsibility for all of these wastes off of production, off of manufacturing, and onto the individual, and construct it as a problem. All of this, you know, huge amounts of waste between 1960 and 1980, the waste produced in the U.S. quadrupled. And that's not because of consumer choices. That's because of changes in production. That's because of choices that manufacturers were making, not because of choices that individual consumers were making. And yet they very craftily shifted the burden onto the individual. And we all remember these ads from the 1970s with the crying, ironized Cody, who is, you know, dressed in Native American garb and would come across these litter-strewn forests and shed a tear because he was sad about the environment. You know, these are ads that Keep America Beautiful made, and it was really good jujitsu because it made everyone feel guilty that watched it, but actually the real perpetrators in this whole scenario were the very people that were telling us that we're responsible.
Do you talk about much about, is it important to your work, exactly what the garbage stream is, or the waste stream is made up of?
It's important from some perspectives. I think that there are people doing work analyzing it in different ways for other reasons, but for the arguments that I make in the book, it's interesting to think about what the potential, you know, what the potential is. Like, if you've got more than a third of all landfill space being taken up by packaging waste, you know, well, what does that say about what kind of actions we can take? You know, it says, like, there's a lot of room for us to get rid of a lot of packaging that we obviously don't need. And packaging is interesting because it's a commodity that's barely perceptible as a commodity. It's also this thing, this category that we've, you know, that's been created, and that I think very much our culture has accepted as a substance that, you know, isn't quite a commodity. It isn't quite just garbage, but actually it is a commodity, and it contains natural resources, and it contains labor, and it's garbage waiting to happen. And often, you know, you walk into a grocery store, and if you look at it from a certain perspective, you know, you look at the aisles, and they're full of all these packages that are, as soon, you know, within minutes of being bought, will become garbage. And you see, you know, it sort of just crystallizes how irrational the system is. Another component of the, you know, what, you know, I don't really like using the term waste stream, even though I used it a couple minutes ago, because it sort of cleanses and you know, it has this, I mean, the language of all this is pretty interesting, like the sanitary landfill. You know, there's this, they try to clean the language of it so that we don't feel bad about it. But, and some people, like, there's a woman in Oakland, California, actually in Berkeley now, Mary Lou Vandeventer, who runs Urban Ore, which is a great place there, a reuse place. She calls it the discard stream because she believes that there's nothing that is truly useless And so so some people choose their words very carefully, and I'm not quite as careful as that. But at any rate, so in terms of the composition of landfills, another statistic that's interesting is that 60% of what's in U.S. landfills could be composted. So that's another potential area for activism in terms of, you know, getting municipal composting programs up and running, because that, you know, again, represents a huge amount that, that we could be using and turning it into soil, and it, it doesn't have to be wasted.
You mentioned the term corporatization of garbage. Talk a little bit more about what that means.
The way that garbage has been taken over, first turned into an industry and then taken over by large multinational corporations like Waste Management, which currently is now, you know, it was operating all over the globe and has scaled back and is now only operating in Canada and the U.S. It has significant impacts on the future of garbage handling, because they, first of all, the top three garbage corporations control 40% of the market, and it's a between $45 and $50 billion market annually, which is huge. And some estimates put it higher than that, near $70 billion. So it's a huge market and increasingly dominated by a handful of corporations. And the meaning of that is that these people, like I said before, the more trash, the more cash, and their motivation is to get as much garbage into the landfill as possible. The other implication is that they're doing all the research and research and development for future technologies of waste disposal. So, for example, now Waste Management is working on these new generation of sanitary landfills called bioreactor landfills. And simply, these are full, you know, landfills that have reached capacity, which they then irrigate with waste liquids, often toxic liquids, to try to get the organic components to break down and get the landfill to settle so that there's more room for more garbage. Now, what this does is it makes an obstacle for expanding composting programs, because they've got this technology which can, they say, handle organic waste better and more safely and more effectively and efficiently than composting, which is, I think, you know, fundamentally untrue. And yet they, you know, they're investing, Waste Management alone has invested more than $20 million in this program. They've got the support of the EPA. They've got support of local governments. And so they're busy galvanizing, you know, the momentum toward shifting the future of waste treatment in the direction that they want it to go. And in order to, you know, to combat that, for people that want to, say, start municipal composting programs, it presents a pretty difficult struggle. Mm-hmm. You know, so these corporations taking over, it means a lot today, but it also, it reaches into the future in ways that we need to be aware of.
Yeah, I was also thinking that it connects with the whole issue of jobs. I mean, there are areas of the country where, you know, industry has pulled out, and what is often sold to people there is, oh, well, we can bring in garbage from other areas of the country and have you deal with it, and then you can have some jobs with that industry.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. Yeah, another way that the garbage corporations do business is they export garbage. And, you know, there's already an incredible amount of inequality in terms of where garbage is handled. And, you know, it's often in neighborhoods where income is low and their neighborhoods populated by people of color. And what you have is that happening within cities at, you know, the sorting and distribution centers called transfer stations, where the trucks go after they collect at the curbside, and then they sort at the transfer station, and trucks go out from there to incinerators, landfills, or recycling centers. Now, when the trucks leave there, it's increasingly common that they're going to, cash-strapped rural regions, you know, again, with, you know, predominantly people of color, and you know, the economies have been hollowed out by deindustrialization and by, you know, by the workings of corporations on another level in other industries. And you have these landfills coming in. You know, in the book I talk about there's a landfill in Pennsylvania where a lot of New York City's waste goes, and it's in a former mine site. And so you have, like, this mine being filled. You know, it was extracted, you know, and now it's being filled in with garbage. And the economy there where this is a disaster. And they need these facilities. They think they need these facilities. It represents some way of earning money for the municipality. But it's you know, landfills are an environment. They're environmental time bombs. And it's a complete, I mean, that's a real economic and health and environmental disaster. And this is being shifted onto the people that are perceived to have, you know, the least amount of political power. And something that's really promising that's happening and has been happening for about the last 10 years is the rise of the environmental justice movement. And that is so important because it makes these crucial connections that the mainstream environmental movement has missed, which is that the exploitation of the environment is deeply connected to the exploitation of labor in this country. And we need to make those connections again. And those are connected to race and class in really important ways that, you know, if we're going to deal with environmental problems, we have to deal with social and economic justice.
A few of your ideas on solutions, because how do you connect garbage so closely with corporatization and economic issues, and then analyze it, accounting for so many solutions that are aimed at individuals? You know, we hear those solutions all the time. You know, when you go to a supermarket, leave the packaging for your item on the floor. I mean, that was popular for a while. So how do you see solutions, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
I think it's important to think about solutions not so much in terms of individual choices. I mean, it's really important, the choices that each of us make on a number of levels. And I'm not saying that everyone should start, you know, buying more than they need and throwing away things that can still be used. But I argue this in the book, and I really think this is important because this is a message that we don't hear very often. And it's that it, you know, the burden of all this does not lie with the individual, and it doesn't lie with the choices that each consumer makes. The real source of garbage is production, is the manufacturing process, and it's the choices that manufacturers make. And so we need to reach into the realm of production and change it. We need to make manufacturers use less packaging. And one of the ways that you can do that, and it's not just packaging, again, it's greater product stewardship, greater through greater serviceability and durability. But for example, in Germany, they have a law which was enacted in 1991 called the Packaging Ordinance. And part of this law includes what's called extended producer responsibility. And what this is, in part, it says that producers have to take back, they have to take back some electronics, you know, when people are finished with their computers and buy a new one to update it or upgrade it, then they have to take those back. But also they have to take back packaging wastes and pay to dispose of them. But the part of the packaging ordinance that I think works, in my opinion, is one of the most effective parts, is that the government says that all beverages have to, 72% of all beverages have to be sold in refillable bottles. And they do that. The beverage makers do that. And it cuts down on, you know, hundreds of thousands of tons of garbage every year. It has a really high participation rate. Over almost 70% of Germans say they would prefer to take their empties back to the grocery store because they want to play a role in making this, you know, a nicer safer, cleaner planet to live on, and that's a really direct way that they can do that. And so, and so there's one example of a solution that's pretty straightforward. And you know, you always get the argument from manufacturers that if they do something like that, it'll ruin the economy and it'll kill jobs and all that. But you know, we've got today, since the year 2000, over 2 million jobs have been outsourced, have left the country. 2 million skilled, union, you know, secure jobs have left this country, and they've been replaced by more, by less than half that number of service sector jobs that don't have benefits, that don't have job security. And so really we need to ask the question, like, what's the economic spoiler for the little guy? Is it better environmental policy, or is it the status quo?
Okay, Heather, I want to thank you for coming in and talking about your work and your book, Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. Is there anything that you think we've missed that needs to be said, or something that you feel needs to be emphasized here in this very last bit of the interview?
Not really.
Okay. Okay. Well, I want to thank you and look forward to wherever this leads you in the future. Enjoy talking with you. Thank you very
much. Thank you. I enjoy talking with you, too.
And let me tell people again, I've been speaking with Heather Rogers. The title of her book is Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. And it's published by
The New Press.
The New Press. This is Kathleen Stevenson for The Radio Zine.